Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Talk radio across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, and it is the home of Common Sense. But most of you know that. I just remind some people in case they're listening for the first time, because, of course, a lot of people are. A lot of people get drawn like moths to a flame coming in for the first time. Welcome to all of you. Welcome to everybody who's been listening for a long time. And welcome to all of you who only listen every now and again. Don't forget to tell people about the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, because it is the only place to hear the truth, the whole truth of nothing but the truth. Now, this morning, we're going to be talking about those idiots on the M25, those morons who have been at it again this morning. Insulate Britain back on the warpath, and this time they were actually sitting down across the M25, bringing traffic going both ways to a complete standstill. At least this time, the police took swift and decisive action, actually physically dragging them off the road and pulling them out of the way. So well done to the police, but I'm saying something now has to happen, because this nonsense has reached crisis proportions, and it is time we put a stop to these dangerous idiots once and for all. They say they don't have any choice but to block roads. They say they're doing it because they love everyone and care for the future of the planet, but they're causing chaos, acting like terrorists, and fast becoming the most unpopular campaign in the history of demonstrating. The time has come, ladies and gentlemen, to crack down hard on these zombies, start fining them heavily, start confiscating their property and blockade them inside their own homes, because if something isn't done soon, they are going to bring this country to a complete standstill. And after all, what kind of government do we have if they can't actually stop this from continually happening? It's all very well saying, oh, we're going to solve climate change, we're going to make sure the energy crisis is going to come to a complete standstill as well. But if you can't actually stop these idiots, these aging hippies, from sitting down on our roads, what is the actual point? We'll be seeking the counsel of barrister and commentator Bobby Friedman, 0344 499 1000. We'll see if we can frame some laws during the course of the next half an hour. We'll bring you also the latest from the energy crisis as well with Roger Helmer, former MEP. Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng promised yesterday that the lights would not go out in Britain. Always a tricky one, that. But ironically, there is now a shortage of CO2, and there's a chance we will have to import it from the USA under some kind of heavy subsidy. We'll be taking your calls this morning because so many people have been royally robbed by the big energy companies, and I don't really fancy bailing anybody out with taxpayers' money, do you? Laura Dodsworth's going to be here as well. She's got plenty to say about the rolling out of the vaccination programme to our children. We'll be finding out exactly what is going on around the country in our schools, as some of the big pharma companies are now saying they've run successful trials with children as young as 5. Really? What on earth is going on? 0344 499 1000. And we'll be investigating why so many doctors are now asking for proper statistics on just how many operations have been cancelled as a result of the COVID obsession. The government has admitted that no recent estimate is available, and so it is clearly a massive problem. So tell us what's going on in your neck of the woods. Kevin O'Sullivan is here ahead of his big show tonight, and we'll be going live to Washington, D.C. with White House correspondent Ksenia Pavlovich McAteer, who will set the scene before Joe Biden meets Prime Minister Boris Johnson later on today. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, just before we go to Bobby Friedman, whose esteemed legal advice I will be seeking counsel from, let's have a look at what one of these Insulate Britain types has to say for himself.
My name is Harry. I'm an energy engineer, and I'm here because insulating Britain will deliver the greatest reduction in CO2 emissions per pound invested. I'm here because it will take millions of people out of fuel poverty. And I'm here because it will create around 1 million proper, meaningful jobs. And I don't want to be here. And I'm sorry to disturb you, but it means a lot.
So there's three things wrong with Harry. One, he looks like a zombie. He looks as if somebody's fed him with some kind of drug. Two, he's probably not an energy engineer, is he? Probably making that up. And three, he says he doesn't want to be there. Well, that makes two of us, Harry. Hazza, we don't want you to be there either. So get lost, shove off, and don't bother coming back. Thanks very much indeed. Let's talk to Bobby Friedman, barrister and political commentator. Bobby, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Now, when I think of something that can be solved by an illegal means, I think of Bobby Friedman. So what can we do? Because we keep hearing that the police have got the powers to arrest these people. And today, I'm happy to say that the police did their jobs and got them off the road pretty fast. But it seems to me that it's not good enough to keep arresting them and allowing them to go back and do it again tomorrow.
Well, I think you're right. The starting point, there has to be that the police take action. And it is welcome today, isn't it, that they finally pulled their fingers out and actually did something about it? Because what we saw last week was ludicrous, wasn't it? Because the police have the power to remove people. Look, you don't need a lawyer to tell you that it's a criminal offence to go and block the traffic on a motorway. Any idiot knows that that's the case. Mm. But it seems that we do have some useful idiots in the police who decide that instead of actually arresting these people, clearing the roads, they're going to let them sit there for hours and hours on end, creating massive disruption. And you know, the thing is, today was a very good example of why effective policing will stop this happening. Because ultimately, if the police get there within 10 minutes, don't get me wrong, yes, it still causes inconvenience. Yes, it's still a danger to normal people. But if we clear them out of the way in 10 minutes, well, it minimises the protest. If you let them sit there for 6 hours, then it encourages them to come back and do it again. So we've got to start with having police who actually enforce the law.
Yes. I mean, is there also an issue about police bail? Because I was listening to one expert this morning talking about how there is police bail, but it's very rarely used in these kinds of cases. And it seems to me that what you need to do is, if you are charging somebody with an offence, whether it be blocking a public highway or a breach of the peace or whatever, that you somehow put some conditions on their release, i.e. you can't go back to the M25. If you do, we're going to lock you up for a month.
Yeah, and I think that's a very fair point there, that all the time when it comes to bail, conditions are imposed on bail requirements. And that's essentially saying to people, it's fine, we don't need to lock you up in prison while you're waiting for a trial on a crime, but you have to behave yourself. And I think it would be perfectly reasonable to impose these kinds of conditions on protesters. If they're going to be released and go and commit another crime immediately, then I think that's something that could be looked at. I wonder whether we should be looking at whether there could be injunctions obtained against these people. But as I say, the problem with all of this, in a way, is that actually it's still, if you have someone, no sensible person thinks that it's a proportionate response to go and sit on the M25. Mm. Regardless of what you think of whether we should be insulating homes, not necessarily a bad idea, is it? But it's who thinks you should go and sit on the M25? So I think it may be hard sometimes to just stop these people physically from going to do it. But it comes back to the fact that if they're free to go and do it and then sit there for 6 hours, that gives them exactly what they want. And so we've mishandled these protests from the start, and that's why it's encouraged them. If we pulled them off the motorway, if I had gone and sat on the motorway last week, I'd have been pulled off by the police in 30 seconds, and that would have been the end of it. So we have encouraged these protests by allowing them to take place.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know whether insulating everybody's home is a good idea or not, but 29 million homes to be insulated, at what cost, I have no idea. I don't think they've given it much thought, these people. They might as well be asking for the letter M to be stricken from the English language, or for all tortoises to have their shells removed. I mean, it means nothing, really, because it's not going to happen. And whenever I hear them speak, and I'm not ever going to let them on this show, by the way, until they promise me and make some meaningful statement about never doing a demonstration on the M25 again, they keep saying, oh, we just want a meaningful statement from the government. I don't even know what that even is. So I'm not even sure they know what they want in order to stop doing whatever they're doing. And a bit like Extinction Rebellion. I mean, the idea that we are not made aware of climate change, that we don't know that climate change is going on, that we somehow need to be made more aware of it, is complete cobblers, isn't it?
Well, it is, because you only have to look at what is actually happening in New York at the moment. They'll be waking up there around now. And what is Boris Johnson doing? He's over there trying to get $100 billion of funding to deal with climate change. He got a billion yesterday from Jeff Bezos. Mm. So it's not like this government actually isn't taking climate change seriously. We actually have a government that is actually dealing with climate change. And that's what's so galling about this, which is that if you have a proposal to make, you know, I'm not an energy engineer.
Don't worry, neither is Harry.
So, well, exactly. I'm in good company.
I mean, if he's an energy engineer, I'm the king of Prussia.
But I don't know. But if you want to have a discussion about it, the political debate at the moment is perfectly amenable to sensible suggestions for how to deal with climate change. This is a government that's dealing with it with open arms. So the idea that you have to go and make this kind of protest just makes no political sense at all. And actually, it's politically stupid, because let me tell you, the one people we should not set of people we shouldn't engage with is Insulate. Because if you encourage people to carry out protests, and we all know the horrific story of the lady who had a stroke, was stuck in the motorway and might well have been left with quite minor consequences as a result, but instead has been left with life-changing injuries as a result of it. We've all seen these stories. You cannot allow that to be the way in which you get to become part of the public discourse and the dialogue about what policy should be. Sensible people putting forward sensible proposals to deal with climate change. We should be talking to them, listening to them. Not these people who want to go around ruining our lives because they think they're entitled to go and sit on the motorway.
Well, exactly. Because all you've got to do is look at what has happened over the course of the last few years, where Boris Johnson, inexplicably, in my view, has become a sort of Green Party prime minister, seemingly obsessed not only with trying to get zero COVID, but now obsessed with making the planet greener and leading from the front and being the world leader in global change in terms of what he's ordering people to do to operate their lives differently. But the thing is that the more that he gives in to these people, the more they want. We've seen Greta Thunberg already saying that Britain is a bit dodgy when it comes to carbon accounting and that we basically make stuff up. She's accused Scotland of not being a very good country when it comes to dealing with climate change. And she demands that more should be done. And you're kind of wondering what on earth is going on.
Well, particularly when you have China, who aren't even signed up to come to the climate change summit later this year. So you look at where the responsibility lies. We as a country are actually doing a huge amount. But as I say, it's not about saying that we can't have sensible conversations about all of this, but it's the arrogance, really. That's what I find. It's the sense that your half-baked opinion that you've come up with suddenly becomes so important that you have to impose it on the rest of the country. You know, it's like me saying that I should be allowed more slices of toast for breakfast, and because of that, I'm going to go and block every train in the country because I want people to talk about it. Right. It's nonsense and it's undemocratic.
Yes. And does it need, therefore, Bobby, do you think, to be looked at in a different way? So as, for example, as we look at the Police and Crime Bill, you know, we've got demonstrations which are, we are told, in some kind of peril, and free speech is at risk because of the way the government wants to treat certain demonstrations. But I think there has to be a delineation point between walking down a street, making a political point with thousands of people or two people, and sitting somewhere for hours on end or days on end, because it's a different thing, isn't it?
It is a different thing. And I think at the one end of the scale, you've got peaceful protest, which we want to encourage. And I think we have to be very careful about trying to categorise protests by what they're asking for, because you don't know which government's in power. And of course, 5-10 years down the track, there could be a government that disagrees with you and wants to stop you putting forward your point of view. So I think we have to be really careful about trying to make it based on what you're protesting about. But you've got peaceful protest, which we allow in this country and we should encourage in this country. But that protest isn't peaceful. It isn't peaceful because we've already seen that it causes people to be injured. Even if you're not physically hitting someone over the head with a stick, that doesn't mean that you're not hurting them. If you stop them, go to a hospital, for example, that's one way of causing injury to someone. And it's not proportionate and it's not reasonable. And I don't think as a country we want to be encouraging. And that's that was the worst part of this. As I say, we saw the police encouraging protesters last week to cause immense disproportionate disruption to all of our lives.
And I think that is the problem at the moment. We're sort of suffering from overkill on demonstrations. You know, if you live in London, it seems to me that there seems to be almost every single week something going on, demonstrations with lots and lots of people involved in them, almost all of which cause disruption. And it's almost like it's a kind of an outbreak of campaigning that we're seeing, because I think people are encouraged that if they do it, they might get what they want.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. For me, I quite like protests on the street in a way. I think that if it's done in the right way, that's people being engaged in politics. And look, there'll be protests that you agree with, protests you don't agree with. And of course, it is, if you're wanting to go down Park Lane on a weekend, of course, it's more annoying if it's someone you don't agree with blocking it than if it's someone you do. But I think that as long as people do it in the right way, and it's an organised protest, you make your point. Then that's fine. It's having wildcat protests that is the problem, and it's also having a protest that is out of any proportion, because this is an idea that's just been cooked up, however recently, and suddenly it's being said, well, we can do effectively whatever we want in order to get that message across. And that's not the right way to go about a protest. And of course, if you allow them, and again, it's the same point applies, you never know what the next protest is going to be. So even for the Insulate protesters, even if they believe in their cause, do they really think it would be right for someone else to go and block the motorways for something else that they disagree with?
Yeah.
So it makes no sense. You can't allow the country to be brought to a standstill in this way.
No, you really can't. Bobby, stay with us for a moment, because I've got a couple of other questions for you. I'd like to see some changes made in the law in order to stop these idiots from doing what they've been doing. For the past week, five times they've basically broken the law, and five times they've been allowed to go back and do it again. And it seems to me that something has to change.
This is Talk Radio across the UK, online, on DAB+, and on the Talk Radio app. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We're talking to Bobby Friedman, barrister, political commentator, about the mess that is being caused on an almost daily basis now by these people from Insulate Britain, who seem to have got the idea that it's a great idea to insulate every home in Britain. 29 million homes they want insulated. They don't say who's going to pay for it. They don't say why the government should do it. They don't know what they're going to insulate the homes with. There doesn't seem to be any plan at all. But we heard from Harry in this hour, who is, of course, claiming that he's an energy engineer, whatever that is, and that he's demonstrating. I hope whoever hires him and uses him as an energy engineer, if indeed he is, gets rid of him as quickly as possible, because clearly he is taking the mickey out of everybody, including those people who pay him to do an actual job. Bobby, some people have said that this behaviour, this persistent troublemaking behaviour, is akin to a kind of terrorism campaign. Now, that may be a little bit on the harsh side, but is there any chance that you could sort of make an organisation like Insulate Britain a proscribed organisation, if you like, and make them a sort of an illegal band of people?
Well, I think that would be very difficult to do. I mean, there are, whatever one thinks about their protests, and obviously you've heard my views before, I mean, there is a huge difference between them and a terrorist organisation.
Yeah.
They are using sort of guerrilla tactics, but they are obviously not going out of their way to cause to deliberately seek to hurt people or kill people. Though of course, as I say, some of the impact of what they've done is to have hurt people, caused injury to people. I think we have to be careful about going too far in dealing with them. And as I say, I don't think there should be. We should be trying to stop people to be members of organisations that have things to say about how this country should be run. I've got no problem with them putting forward their points of view. The problem I have is the means by which they're trying to do it. But as I say, what we the fundamental issue we have is that you only have to look at the fact the police pulled them off the motorway today. Why were they not able to do that last week? I just sat there watching, and you saw saw individual drivers basically going up to the protesters and wanting to drag them off, and the police stopping those drivers from doing that. Those were drivers who wanted to actually stop people from committing crimes. Mm. It's the wrong way round. And there's this muddle-headedness when it comes to policing, that the default seems to be to, if someone has an in vogue protest, to seem to allow them to do whatever they want in order to do that. And then you compare it, for example, during the protests after the death of Sarah Everard, where the Mets, for reasons that were completely incomprehensible, came down on the peaceful protesters like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
So I just think that there is something basically wrong with how the police react to protests. And their antennae just get it wrong pretty much every single time.
Yeah. Well, that's the trouble, because it does appear as though somebody somewhere makes a decision on how these demonstrators are to be treated. And clearly, as you say, today and yesterday to some extent, because they did a bit more sort of hard graft yesterday as well. Somebody's obviously told the police, right, now you can steam in and drag these people off the roads. It's the only way we can deal with them. In the same way that they were told to be very standoffish and take the knee when the BLM were protesting around central London in quite violent manner at times. And in the same way that they steam in on any sort of anti-vax or anti-lockdown protest, literally punching people on the ground.
Yeah, I just don't understand why some protests end up getting this level effectively of protection. You know, as I say, if I were to wander out onto the M25 this afternoon, I would rightly be dragged off. But we saw it last week where there was simply no desire to get people off. And the excuse is given, for example, saying, well, it was too dangerous to try and remove people from the motorway. Mm. Just doesn't make any sense at all. It's absolutely right that obviously if people are stood on the motorway, as a responsible police force, you have to stop ensure the traffic is stopped behind it so that it's safe for your officers to go into the road. And once you do that, you pick the people up and you get them off the side of the road. It's not difficult.
Right.
Believe me, that they're well capable of doing that. So it just seems to be a series of misjudgments, but I think that goes right to the top of the police force.
I think that's absolutely right. Bobby, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Bobby Friedman there, barrister, political commentator, on the nonsense that has been going on for the past week or so, thanks to these maniacs from Insulate Britain, who seem to think that the way forward to save the planet is to insulate everybody's house in Britain. If you just think about that for a second and think about the size of Britain and think about the size of the planet, and think about the size of what is regarded, generally speaking, as the problem of causing climate change. I mean, even if Britain could insulate 29 million homes, it would probably take years. It would probably take billions and billions of pounds to do. And what difference would it make exactly? We've got an energy crisis going on. Energy prices are going up. You're going to tell me that if you insulate loads and loads of people's homes, they will use less energy. That may well be. But how's that going to save the planet? Exactly. And how is stopping traffic on the M25 doing any good whatsoever? I want to have some ideas today as to what we do with these people. I would be quite happy to lock some of these people up for a very long time. If they continue to be recidivists, if they continue to ignore warnings that they should stop doing it, then surely they must be punished, mustn't they?
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
And here we are. It's a lovely sunny day out there. It's actually going to be 20-something today, so it's a rather pleasant September morn. And here is Laura Dodsworth. Laura, very good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's nice out there, isn't it?
It's gorgeous. I love a day like this. I feel like it's a promise. It's
yes.
A promise of good things. When the day starts like this in September, and today, by the way, is autumn equinox.
Oh, is it?
It is, 21st September.
Okay.
So it's the beginning of autumn. It just feels like the day should hold beautiful things.
Yes, and it's always a nice time of the year for me. It would have been my father's birthday yesterday, September the 20th.
Aww.
He died a few years ago, but he was a great man. One of the many inspirations to my way of being, you might say. He sort of gave me the wherewithal to be questioning of almost everything and to treat everybody the same and to basically go through life trying not to do any harm to anyone.
That is so lovely.
And if we had a government like that, we'd be a lot better off, wouldn't we?
Yes. We don't, though, do we?
No,
yeah.
We really don't. I was horrified when I saw that Chris Whitty was going to overrule the JCVI, when we talked about this last week.
Mm.
And then when they announced that Monday of this week was going to be the day they rolled out the vaccination programme for children, I just couldn't quite believe I was living in a country that would do that.
Yeah, I know. But do you know what? They're not all bad. I want to give a big shout out this morning to the marvellous MP Miriam Cates.
Yes.
I'm going to be thoroughly glowing about her because this morning there's a parliamentary debate in Westminster Hall about vaccinating teenagers. Now, she said something that is exactly what we were talking about last week, Mike. Mm. I think she was listening.
I bet she was.
Right, so here's her quote. Given the known and unknown risks of vaccinating healthy children and that 40 to 70% are estimated already to have antibodies, what plans do you have, that's Nadeem Zahawi, to offer antibody testing to children so the parents can make an informed decision? Well, this is exactly what we were talking about last week. And we've had the mantra, following the science, dogmatically parroted to us, the British people, for 18 months, and now the government is not following the science.
Yes.
Because if a teenager has had the infection, then they have long-lasting, excellent protection from COVID, and then they would be completely unnecessarily exposed to the side effects and the rare but serious adverse effects which they can get from the vaccine. And that's why it was a difficult decision for the JCVI, because there are side effects and adverse effects. So why are we not following the science anymore? So she's put that question to Nadeem Zahawi. He said he's going to write with his reply, and he needs to write that reply with the utmost urgency.
Yes.
Because vaccines are being rolled out this week.
And what I don't know, and I'm happy to take calls on this later on in the hour, because what I don't know is whether or not parents are being asked if they wish for their children to be vaccinated. I've seen online, and I think you know about this, a consent form, which not only has two or three pages of guff on it, which none of which is a fact, basically, sort of telling children, oh, you know, this will make everybody safer, this will reduce your risk of getting COVID, this will reduce your risk of dying from COVID. But it also has a section where it says, if you do not consent, would you mind telling us why, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is that about?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Is it because your parents are anti-vaxxers? I mean, you might as well ask that question.
Yeah, so you know how I like to do my homework for your show. I've written a few pages of notes on this consent form because I was not happy when I saw it. Now, I'm no expert on consent forms for teenagers for vaccinations, but I suspect they don't normally look at them because it's normally the parent who gives consent. So it has been written in a child-centric approach. We were told it'd be child-centric. I would say it's a little beyond child-centric. It's quite juvenile and it's very low on facts.
And there's lots of silly little pictures, aren't there?
There's lots of pictures. I mean, that might be helpful for some 12-year-olds. I don't know. But it's so low on facts. I don't understand how it's putting informed consent into the hands of teenagers or their parents. Now, that refusal box, that's interesting. It says, if you don't want to have the vaccine or you do not want your child to have the vaccine, can you tell us why? And then underneath it says, you don't have to tell us. Too right, you don't have to tell them. It's absolutely none of their business.
Right.
Whether you accept or decline a medical intervention is your business.
Right.
And it's no one else's business. Now, this form is supposed to be returned to the appointment. So whether you've given your consent or not, it's returned at school. So it's obvious that this is ethically problematic for the reason for refusal to be written on a form that will be handed back at schools. I don't want to cast any aspersion on schools, teachers, head teachers, or the medical people giving the vaccinations, but it could obviously create an undue pressure or a discrimination on the child. They shouldn't have to state their reason.
No.
And just saying you don't have to tell us isn't enough. That box just shouldn't be there at all.
Well, how about you don't have a form? Why should you have to give consent or not give consent? I mean, either you agree to have the vaccine or you don't, surely. I mean, you don't have to say, I do not want it, and put that down in writing, do you?
Well, at the moment, I do something similar with online forms for the vaccinations. Mm. Vaccinations I normally just consent to. You know, these are, you do have to say whether you consent or not.
Yeah.
And it should be clear for the people administering the vaccine so that they know what's going on. But it's normally an online form that the child isn't actually involved with. Now, this form has clearly been through the Behavioural Insights people. It's obvious in the design of it. But not only that, I know from an inside NHS comms person who talks to me that everything goes through Behavioural Insights, every press release, every form, all the public messaging around COVID. And there are some good reasons for that, to make sure things are consistent, easily understood. But it's also to make sure that things are psychologically as effective as possible. So, for instance, the first option is that you do give your consent before you give your refusal. The first option is that the child gives their consent before the parent gives their consent. It's all geared up towards you.
So it's all done in a particular order.
It's all geared towards you saying yes,
yes,
towards the child saying yes. And, of course, it's got this refusal box on, which is something new.
But also the wording of that's interesting to me, because what they should really say is that, you know, while it is not, while it is your right not to give a reason for not wanting this vaccination, it would be very helpful to us if you were able to tell us why, which would be a much better way of doing it than saying, if you are refusing to take the vaccine, please tell us why. But then you don't have to tell us.
But it should.
You know what I mean?
I do firmly believe it shouldn't be done on a piece of paper that's returned to a school.
No.
Because people can then read that. So that information is important, but it should be done in a strictly confidential, anonymised way.
Yes.
That is not. Because I imagine, doesn't go into the school.
Yeah, I imagine
it should
they're
be
not
online.
Giving you an envelope to put it back into, are they? They're probably just returning it to the school receptionist or something. But the other thing is that for
me. Do you have a teenager? They are not going to be putting this in an envelope. Or if they do, they're opening it. It's going to be in the bottom of a school bag and then thrust out open towards a teacher.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you'll find any number of letters from the school in the bottom of your son's bag, I'm sure. Time of the year from 6 months ago. But you know, also they're very careful at the chief medical officer's office to say that they are offering this vaccine to people rather than they're, you know, asking people to get it. So therefore, in my view, if you're, and this is a legal kind of technicality for me, if you're offering something, then the person who wishes to accept that offer goes to you and says, I'm willing to accept your offer. You don't have to turn it down because that's immaterial. If you don't want it, you don't do anything, right?
Yeah. Well, this is a behavioural science approach, I feel. I mean, they're trying to gather information, but they're not doing it in a way that's ethically of the best standard, I think. OK, so I've got another couple of big areas of concern with this consent form. It has a very interesting line on it. It says, you don't have to keep following the government's rules if you have been vaccinated, but they will help to keep you safe. Well, what does this mean?
Which rules are they talking about?
Well, it could be, for instance, masks or social distancing or bubbles, but does this suggest that the teens who are vaccinated don't have to follow the rules, but the unvaccinated teens may have to? Mm. And then I thought, no, surely the government could not stoop that low to incentivise vaccination. Surely there would not be different rules for the vaccinated and the unvaccinated in schools, especially as we know that this vaccine doesn't even prevent transmission. That would be unscientific and discriminatory. And given that Chris Whitty said that the mental health of teenagers was one of the reasons to offer them vaccination, they couldn't possibly implement a system of discrimination, you could even call it apartheid, like that, which would actually destroy mental health for teenagers. But that line's definitely caused me some alarm.
I think so, because the whole situation is alarmist, really. And I was interested to know, and I think since the last time you and I spoke, I heard a headmaster from one of the headmaster unions on Julia's show who said, look, this is not for the schools like the testing system was, whereby you get a load of boxes of tests that arrive. And I know from what they did in my son's school that they basically handed the test out, you know, in classrooms and said, right, here's a box of tests to take home. We want you to do two a week, blah, blah, blah. For those of you who are doing them, you know, my son wasn't doing them, so he didn't take a box test. But as far as the schools are concerned, they're not going to administer the vaccine. So all they're saying is that if the NHS wants to do the vaccinations in the school, they will give them a space in which to do it. And that's all their involvement will be. So I think a lot of the schools have got cold feet now and they're kind of going, we don't really want to be involved in this. And I think that's right, because if you want to vaccinate children, why not ask them to go to a vaccination centre? Why do you want to do it in the school?
Yeah, that would make a lot more sense. And one argument could be because it's to minimise disruption to schooling. On the other hand, we know that some schools are also saying don't come in the next day if you suffer side effects. It's kind of a crazy way of thinking about it, really. Have the vaccine to minimise disruption to schools, but you might feel so ill the next day you don't want to come in.
Right.
The thing is, they can try to separate themselves from it, but those children are still on school premises. If they feel ill later, for instance, it will still be the school who's looking after them. We know that there might be school assemblies or life skills classes on vaccination. The school can't really simply offer itself as a venue and have no other involvement.
Right.
That's just not realistic.
No, because they have to disrupt the school day, presumably, in order to get people into that particular place to get the vaccination done.
There's all the queuing, and if they're given a proper, decent discussion, which would arrive at some form of informed consent, such as it is, that's going to take time. What, 15 minutes? It's going to be enormously disruptive. Actually, talking about disruption, Canada is the first country, I think, that's rolled out the vaccination to all of its school children. It's not going very well there. They're closing schools in some provinces, as well as reintroducing face masks and testing. So I'm not confident about how that's even going to work out here this winter. We've already been told that it's an adjunct to other actions. You know, vaccinating teenagers isn't a magical solution anyway, because we know it doesn't stop infection or transmission. If you want to stop disruption to schooling,
stop disrupting it.
Simply stop asymptomatic, stop disrupt. But it's, of course, it's a policy decision, but stop asymptomatic testing.
Yes.
Now, so many experts with a wealth of evidence-based medicine and public health have been ignored throughout this. And if we just listen to them, if government had just listened to them earlier, so many of these problems could have been avoided. Carl Hennehan was answering MPs' questions in the House of Commons back in September 2020. And he said that if you randomly go into schools and mass test, you may as well shut the schools down right now.
Yeah.
He'd never seen anything like it in all his years as a GP or an evidence-based medicine practitioner. And he recommended that asymptomatic testing not go ahead. But we know what happened after that. The UK government did roll out asymptomatic testing. Education was damaged. And it's probably partly why we're in the mental health crisis we're in now for teenagers.
Yes. And as far as I understand it, they're still doing it. They're still testing in schools until, as far as I'm aware, at the end of this month when they're going to review it. But have you also noticed something else creeping in? And this is coming from Mark Drakeford's announcement last week that they were going to have vaccine passports, right? He's now saying things like, oh, yes, well, we know that it's not on in and of itself a measure that will protect you, but along with all the other measures, it will be good. And that was when he was referring to going back to wearing face masks and face coverings, as they like to call them in Wales, because he's going, well, it might not be the case that this will stop you getting COVID, but it will help. So if you do this along with all these other things that you can do, then you'll be safer. And so they're sort of shifting it all very subtly into, we're not asking you to wear a face mask because it stops you getting COVID, because you can make an argument against that. They're saying, do it because it's part of a kind of, you know, collection of things that you can do.
A collection of useless, unevidence-based things.
Right.
Brilliant.
I know.
What's next? Wear chicken suits. That will work.
Well, exactly right. And they also haven't really defined yet what an event size is, which is going to require a vaccine passport. Nobody really knows the answer. Anything over 10,000 if it's outside, but inside, we don't know.
Well, it's zero for me because I won't go to them.
No.
I find it really appalling that there'll be people who are left outside.
Yeah.
I just think it's a horrendous state of affairs for a modern democratic society in 2021 to say that, you know, if you don't have this intervention that we know isn't a magic bullet and won't stop infection, you can't come in.
Right.
We know that's going to mainly affect certain groups of people who'll be outside. So I'd rather stand outside with them.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. Laura Dodsworth is here. She is the author, of course, of State of Fear, one of the great books of the pandemic, you might say. We'll be talking some more coming up very shortly. But if you've got any information that we can use, by all means, do let us have it. You can tweet us at Talk Radio, at IROMG. What's going on in your school? What's going on with your children? Are they being offered a vaccination? Or is it all going on sort of in the background?
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let's talk now, though, about the energy crisis, because yesterday those immortal words were issued by Kwasi Kwarteng, the business secretary. The lights will not go out in Britain. Now, there are certain things that you can say in Parliament. There are certain things that you can't say. And saying that really does tempt me to suggest that that might be the complete opposite of what does happen. Because what we have right now is an energy crisis of pretty serious dimensions, because apparently we're running out of CO2 as a result of a shortage of gas supply. We have got massive price rises going on. Over 200% is the price of gas that has risen over the course of the last year. People's electricity bills are going up by at least a third. Some people reporting to me that their direct debit is moving from £60 a month to £100 a month. I mean, that is an outrageous amount of money. Let's talk to Roger Helmer, former UKIP energy spokesperson, former MEP for the East Midlands as well. Roger, very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. Great to be here.
Yeah, great to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. I mean, I know that sometimes things can come upon us and you know, people have said this is a combination of a series of events happening all at the same time, as it often is. But we really shouldn't be looking down the barrel of a gun on this issue, should we?
Absolutely not. And, you know, forgive me for saying, as it were, I told you so, but for 10 years... First of all, I was very upset when the European Union told us we had to close our coal-fired power stations because we didn't really know what we were going to do instead. Then when there was pressure not to build more gas and not to get shale gas, I mean, the Americans have done brilliantly with indigenous supplies of gas. We didn't do it, so we haven't got that gas. North Sea gas is running out. And our nuclear fleet, our nuclear power stations have been allowed to go into decline. The French have done a bit better than us there with nuclear, and they still get a lot of their power from nuclear. So what are we doing? We're relying on imports of gas. We're relying on interconnectors from Europe. Now, we've just had this wonderful spat with France, so I don't think France is terribly keen on helping us out if we've got an energy shortage. What we also did a couple of years ago was to close down our main gas storage, which was an installation called Rough up in Yorkshire, so that we have very, very low gas stocks in this country compared to Germany or Holland or other European countries. We've really allowed ourselves to get in a complete bind, and we have said, well, don't worry, because we've got lots and lots of wind power. We're going to be the wind power capital of the world, which is great when the wind blows. But when the wind doesn't blow, which is what we've just seen, we're completely stuffed. Now, it may be in 20 years, 30 years' time, we'll have massive battery storage and we'll be able to pile up, you know, a huge amount of energy for the winter from the wind blowing in the summer, or to take that approach. But at the moment, we can't store anything like the sort of power we would need to run London for half an hour, never mind for 3 weeks. So we're stuffed.
Yes. It seems extraordinary, doesn't it, that we, as a small island off the coast of continental Europe in the middle of the North Sea, isn't windy enough. I mean, I find that very hard to believe. Surely maybe we just have the wind turbines in the wrong places.
Well, no, it is true, actually, that we do have, as they like to say, the best wind resources in Europe. So we've got great places in the North Sea and Scotland, are great places for wind normally, but you can't control the weather. And sometimes the wind blows, sometimes the wind doesn't blow. And what we've left ourselves without is resilience. We don't have anywhere else to turn. There's nowhere else to go to. I mean, thank God the Norwegians, I think, are still supplying us with plenty of gas. But there's huge demand in Asia. So a lot of the places we said, well, we can get it from here, we can get it from there, no problem, get it from the Middle East. Meantime, Russia, of course, you've got Putin, who's turning the screws on Europe. So they're short of gas. They're not going to help us out. And we've really left ourselves without anywhere to turn.
Yes.
What we should have been doing, you know, whenever you propose new energy infrastructure, you know, you want to build a nuclear power station, there are the protesters. You want to get shale gas out of the ground. We've got great shale gas resources in this country. We just don't dig them out. And you suggest we should start getting shale gas, and immediately you've got protesters blocking roads. I like what you said about the Extinction Rebellion guys on the M25, by the way. I agree with you absolutely. But basically, we have to have energy supplies. And that means, I think, at the moment, it has to be gas. We need to have sources of gas. We need to have storage of gas. We need to have enough gas. Gas is a great fuel. It's clean. It only produces half the CO2 of the equivalent energy value of coal. It would be a great transitional fuel if we're going to net zero, and that's a whole other debate, but if we are going to net zero, then gas is a great intermediate bridge, as it were, from coal, which produces a lot of CO2, to 2050, when we're not going to have any CO2, but gas would be a great thing to have in the meantime. The trouble is, we haven't thought about where we're getting the gas from, and we haven't got enough reserves.
No. And is it also a fact, Roger, would you say, that some of the private big companies, and maybe even some of the small companies, have not really invested in their own infrastructure in this country, so that we haven't got a very good kind of, you know, administrative grid, if you like, of all of these companies, because they've always just assumed they'll go get it from the cheapest place?
Well, I think there's a lot of that in it, although certainly you can't blame the newer, smaller energy companies. I mean, they're not in the business of digging out gas or prospecting for it. What you can say is that, I'm losing my facts here, but it was one of the big power companies that made the decision to close the Rough gas storage.
Yes, I think it was Centrica, wasn't it?
Centrica, it may well have been.
Yeah.
So, that was terribly short-sighted. But really, it comes back to the government's door, because the government should have an overall watching brief on this and should make sure that we do have the facilities, the resilience in place to cope with the unexpected. And there's an awful lot of unexpected. You know, there are interconnectors closing down. There was a fire on one of the interconnectors. All sorts of things can go wrong. There's suddenly a rush of demand in Asia, which we didn't anticipate. We don't know when these things are going to happen, but we must have some backup so we can deal with them. And frankly, we just don't have it.
And strangely, we now, as we have many, many campaigns now to reduce the CO2 in Britain, we now have a shortage of CO2, rather ironically, which apparently is going to affect everything from hospitals to food manufacturing to all sorts of, Christmas turkey farms and all the rest of it. But we've got this now massive, ridiculous situation where the government is talking about subsidising American companies to sell us a CO2 and also subsidising gas companies and electric companies because they fear that they're not making enough money.
Well, they've got themselves into a complete bind because they've allowed the supply situation to get so bad. Obviously, prices have gone up. I mean, that's basic economics. You have a severe shortage and suddenly prices go through the roof. That is bound to happen. And to an extent, it should be temporary, provided that we can actually solve this solution of having enough. But it needs a rethink. We need more nuclear in this country. We need more gas in this country. We need gas storage. And we need, in my view, and I've argued for it for years, we need shale gas because we've got it. You know, the Industrial Revolution in Britain in the 19th century was based on coal. And Britain was blessed with lots and lots of coal. We're sitting here now with a country where we've got lots and lots of gas, but we're saying, well, we don't like gas very much, so we're not going to get it out. Well, now we see what happens when we don't get the gas that we need.
Yeah. And what's your thinking, Roger, about what happens over the course of the next couple of weeks? I mean, Boris Johnson said yesterday in the US that he's hoping the market will calm down. But it's not just the market that needs to calm down. It seems to me that they need to look at what's gone wrong and try and make it preventable.
Well, absolutely. And it's really scary the way that Boris Johnson and other government ministers are saying, look, don't worry, it's going to be all right. The lights won't go out. We need more than these bland assurances. We need a plan. We need a real rethink of where we're going to get stuff from. I mean, I think in the short term, in terms of a few weeks, they have to do whatever they have to do. And if that means subsidies from the taxpayer, there's no substitute. Otherwise, we'll go hungry and there'll be empty shelves and there'll be lights out. So they have to do those things. But that's only a short-term fix. It's a sticking plaster. What they've got to do is think seriously about actually how we power a modern economy in a resilient and reliable way through to whatever new plan they have. I mean, I'd be happy to come and talk to you about net zero because I think it's absolute madness and economically destructive. But that, if you like, is a broader debate. But if we are going there, we've got to talk about how we get there without allowing the economy to collapse in the meantime.
Yes, absolutely right. Very well said. Roger, thank you very much indeed. We'd like to hear common sense on this radio show, and Roger has certainly provided us with plenty of that. Former UKIP energy spokesman, former MEP for the East Midlands, of course, as well. We will talk to Roger some more coming up in the future because I think he does have the right attitude. It is nonsensical, is it not, to have all the coal that we have in this country and not use any of it? It is ridiculous to say that we're going to be reliant upon renewable energy that comes from wind farms, that comes from the sea, that comes from all sorts of green methods which don't actually work when the chips are down. If it's not windy enough, wind power isn't any good. That should tell you something. You should have something in reserve. You should have more gas storage capabilities. You should have more energy variations. You should have more ways of actually bringing energy into the country without actually having to buy it from overseas. For heaven's sake, it's not difficult, is it? 0344 499 1000. We're going to take some calls coming up. How about this from Adrian in Daventry? He says, I'm going to start a new protest action group. I'm going to call it Double Glazed Britain. Who's with me? I think that's a good one. Why not? Why not call for giving everybody a garden? Give everyone a garden. Let them live outside. Who needs a house? Don't even bother. Just buy everybody a sleeping bag. I mean, you might as well have any number of ridiculous campaigns you want to lie down on the road about. Because these people, I kid you not, they look like zombies, they act like zombies. I'm beginning to think they are actual zombies. This is Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
So we've spoken a lot over the past few months about the difficulties people have had getting to see a GP, the difficulty of getting a face-to-face consultation, how hard it is to get into various hospitals, how some hospitals have become very quiet over time as the COVID numbers have gone down. Difficult to now get a picture of exactly what is going on, but let's talk to Professor David Taylor, pharmaceutical scientist at UCL. He's also the author of a report which is suggesting that there will be, as we kind of look further into the future, all sorts of difficulties coming up. 10,000 Britons may die of cancer due to the COVID pandemic and delays fueled by a drop in emergency referrals from GPs. Professor David, a very good afternoon to you.
Hi, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for talking to us. This has been a sort of recurrent theme for us on this show because an awful lot of people have been in touch with us for the past several months talking about why and how difficult it is to get to see a GP. And a lot of them are sort of baffled as to why, considering that social distancing has become a thing of the past in most other businesses, why doctors are still operating as if COVID is very much still out there.
Well, I guess it is out there, Mike. And there's good reason for reasonable caution. The NHS hasn't done that badly. And of course, as you were saying earlier on, people are questioning its efficiency. It's worth remembering we spend about half the proportion of GDP or two thirds of the proportion of GDP on health than the Americans do. So perhaps it's something to do with the level of funding because it's tax funded. But either way, there's risk there. Obviously, the COVID epidemic, pandemic, whatever you like to say, caused big problems, and it's caused them everywhere, not just in the UK. That did delay cancer treatment, although lots of other treatment was delayed as well. People suffering pain from bad hips, waiting 1-2 years sometimes, which is extraordinarily bad. In some ways, cancer services have been protected. But what we've got now is both the issue of making sure that any harm done is minimised and at the same time taking up the great opportunities that if we look forward, if we get better early diagnosis, if people aren't frightened of being tested, if they come forward, if they can access good testing and care through their GPs, through hospitals, and if we've got access to the best treatments, whether they're older ones or new ones as they become available, we can further reduce the load of cancer, which we know has changed the lives of so many people in Britain. About 40% of people in Britain say their lives have been changed for the worse because of cancer.
Right. Well, your study says, I think, that 40,000 late diagnoses happened as a result of a drop in emergency referrals from GPs. So, I mean, I don't know whether that's changed now or whether it's been fixed, or do you believe it's still going on?
I think that's an overall figure. We find cancer in lots of ways. Some is emergency referral from GPs, some is routine care, and some, of course, is emergency admission when you've got late-stage symptoms. The 40,000 figure came from another study published in a journal called Lancet Oncology. Nobody really knows the overall burden. We know there was a big hit. We know now we've got both the task and the opportunity of doing better. I think that's the thing to emphasise. And there is evidence that NHS services in emergency referrals recovered. What I want to see is asking some questions about that. At the moment, we use a 3% threshold. That means to say that you only get referred for extra testing if the tests the GPs have been given to use by NICE and by experts indicate there's about a 3% risk of there being a cancer. We think that could be that threshold could be reduced. If you've got a 1 in 50 chance of having a cancer, I guess you'd like to be worked up personally. I think in the States, for example, most people would be very anxious to get checked. I think we can improve things there. There's other sorts of screening and testing. For example, in lung cancer, again, if we take the example of the States, there's something called the US Preventive Services Task Force, which is recommended that all ex-smokers and smokers with a significant record of smoking, age between 50 and 80, have something called low-dose CT scanning, which can pick up early-stage, eminently treatable lung cancers. We've been looking at that for ages and just haven't got any policy yet. I think that's something that needs attention from politicians, from people like you, Mike.
Yes, I mean, I think the problem overall with the NHS is that bits of it work quite well, but lots of it doesn't. I mean, I've got a letter in front of me here from a listener called Philip. I won't give his last name. He didn't say whether I could give that out. But he's got a friend who was waiting for knee surgery, right, replacement knee surgery on his right leg in Essex at the King George Hospital. He was told the waiting list was going to be 3 years minimum. And he was so worried about that that he thought he might try and see what he could do privately. He went to the same orthopaedic consultant, said, how much would it cost to pay for a private operation and how long would it be to wait? The answer was £16,000 and we can do it in 3 days.
So there's if you don't ration by price the ability to pay, the historical trend has been you ration by waiting time. We, because we fund the NHS by taxation, and we do that because it's so important. Our survey work has shown that 80% of people are very firm on wanting a tax-funded NHS, which is universally available. The danger is if we don't fund it well enough, then we have long waiting times. There's a temptation to say, oh, they must be inefficient, but there's absolutely no evidence of that. The evidence is its capacity, whether it's diagnoses, whether it's number of surgeons, that sort of thing. Now, obviously, we've got to guard against efficiency, inefficiency and jobs worth people. Mm. You meet them everywhere. I'm sure you meet them in even in talk radio.
Well, we're a very slim and efficient organisation here at Talk Radio. I'm not sure that you could say the same about other media companies, though, I'm sure.
I'm sure that's right. I'm sure it's true of universities. I'm sure it's true. I've worked in the pharmaceutical industry. It's true everywhere that you get some people that are taking things for a ride, but most people everywhere try hard. And it's very important not to inappropriately blame GPs, just as in the past, some doctors have inappropriately blamed patients for not turning up.
Yes.
We shouldn't blame each other. We should just try and make things better.
Yes, I think that's right. But I think the trouble with the NHS is that there are sections of it which have got really, really top heavy, I think, over the last 20 years in terms of, you know, management consultant types, people getting paid six-figure salaries. And there was one the other day, a woman who's running some kind of diversity department who's making £35,000 more a year than the head of NHS England, you know, and people making sort of £250,000 a year and that kind of thing could pay for 11 nurses. And I know it's easy for newspapers to write those kinds of stories, but it's true. And for people who are trying to access care, you know, to be told that you can't come and see a doctor, or to be told that when you get to the doctor's surgery, you have to wait outside and somebody will come and see you. You know, there's no real excuse for that now, is there?
Don't take me as a great expert on this, Mike, but the last figure I saw was something like 6% of NHS costs go on management. The figures in the US, if we take that as an example, are considerably higher. And I think they compare pretty well across Europe. So, yes, you will be right that bad things happen. And getting back to your example of somebody waiting for knee surgery, I think that's shocking. I think I've even heard in Northern Ireland of people being told they'd have to wait 5 years for a hip replacement. That's shocking. Mm. What I think we've got to be very careful of is thinking we know, oh, that's because of fat cats at the top.
Yes.
Like pretending we can solve all our problems if we only tax the rich. We've all got to contribute. And if we want good public services, the truth is we all have to pay.
Yes, I get that. But equally, it doesn't appear that throwing more money at it necessarily makes it any more efficient either, because we're currently about to be taxed 1.5% or 1.25% more on our national insurance. For some people, that'll turn out to be 2.5%. What would you say that money should be given to? Which part of the service should it be given to? I mean, do you want to hire more doctors? Do you want to hire more nurses, train more doctors? What would you do with it?
Well, remember, that all came from the debate about social care. Right when Labour set up the NHS, there was a division between social care, which itself goes back to the old poor law in the 19th century, the sort of care you get in your own home, and medical care, which was free in the poor law and free in the NHS. What we've done over the last 70 years is tend to dump a lot of things that are in the borderline between home nursing and home support. We've dumped them in social care and we've said you've got to pay. That wasn't free. You're taxed to poverty levels. The big political debate about sorting that out, and you remember when Boris came in, he said he'd got a plan. So in the long term, that 1.25%, which of course is really 2.5% because it's half from you and half from your employer, is scheduled most of it to go to improving social care, injustices like people getting dementia, living for a long time with very severe disability, not being called a disease and losing their houses and things because of it. At least Boris has taken action to put a cap on that, or you can debate how much time and money you should spend yourself. In the short term, what that money's got to go to is one way or another, cutting the waiting list for surgery and the NHS. The issue is in the longer term, will it really be transferred to social care, or will we be looking for another solution for that down the road?
Well, I suspect all of the above will apply, because I don't think that the money will make any difference whatsoever to the waiting times. And I don't think, from what the analysis that I've seen so far has suggested, that the social care cap will make much difference anyway, because it really just sort of puts another little level of protection on very...
Why do you think that, Mike?
Well, because the amount...
When Blair put his foot over Gordon Brown's, much to Gordon Brown's rage, on the accelerator of NHS funding between 2000 and 2010... the waiting times did fall. The money did make a difference. There is evidence there. So why do you think it doesn't?
Because I don't think that the NHS in nowadays terms is anywhere near as efficient as it was, funnily enough, because I think that it's getting so much more money than it got then, and yet it's become worse. So you have to explain that somehow and the only reasonable means I can have of explaining it is that it doesn't use the money as well as it used to. And we've got we've got doctors who leave the business because they want to do more locum work. We've got nurses who leave the business because they can't stand working in there anymore. You know, so you've got a recruitment crisis. You haven't got enough people, and I don't know how you're going to get so many more people in.
I'm not sure the figures actually so that might. The NHS doesn't take that much compared with big systems elsewhere of the GDP. It takes about 7.5% of GDP. Up to the time the pandemic struck. Now, that was actually falling during the period between 2010, 2018. The percentage of our national wealth going on the health service as our wealth increased was falling slightly.
Yes, but it's more actual money, though, isn't it?
You'd have to adjust for inflation. It is
more money. It's more money.
It's slow growth. And as a proportion of all our money, it fell. Then you got the mayhem of the pandemic. And everywhere, people have big problems. What we've got to do now, whatever the past is to look for the most efficient solutions. That I totally agree. Mm. But I wouldn't think that any doctor in the NHS is worse at being efficient than I am. I think we've all got problems and challenges with that. The thing to do is work together. Are you saying you want an alternative to the NHS, something privately funded or something like this? Well, or is there something in between that you'd like?
Well, I think it doesn't work for everybody. Therefore, I think it needs to be changed. And rather than every single year arriving at the same place, which is, you know, the headlines in the papers that say there's another winter crisis in the NHS, which seems to happen every single year because nothing seems to ever change in the way that it's run, I would suggest that there are some tweaks made to it, for example. A lot of doctors say they get a lot of time wasters coming to see them in surgeries who shouldn't really come there. So I would suggest you might charge them money to have an appointment, which could be refundable at certain points or to certain people. You wouldn't want to exclude certain people. But, you know, I just think the system needs tweaking so that it works better. Because, I mean, I don't think you can doubt or disagree with me when I say that an awful lot of it doesn't work very well.
I certainly agree with you when we say we can make things better. Some people, I've talked to people in the current government, some people, of course, think that the National Insurance Scheme could be extended so that you had a particular tax for health and social care, and that would be just for health and social care. You'd take it out of the other tax pot. Mm. That's one thing people are looking at. I'd agree that for people like you and me, say with this lung cancer screening thing, which is so important, we could save lives, although there are downsides as well, if we were checking smokers for lung cancer. It's only 200 or 300 quid for a CT scan. You and I could look at that and think, well, if we've been smokers, maybe we should pay for it. The trouble is, the evidence is those most at risk, almost like vaccine hesitancy, those most least able to look after themselves are often the ones who'd be least willing to pay. So it's balancing that out in terms of getting good community outcomes, but certainly you and I might want the freedom to top up our care. I totally agree.
I mean, I already do that anyway, and most people probably do, and many more people are going private for certain things because they simply aren't willing to wait the length of time that they are being asked to wait because they're in so much discomfort. So I think we're already getting a kind of two-tier system for those who can afford to use private health. So that should be helping the NHS in a way, because it should be reducing the numbers of people reliant upon it.
I think that's true, providing it doesn't take the shortage of staff. One of our scandals is, of course, over the last few decades, one way or another, we used to rely on importing doctors from over the world and nurses. Mm. We haven't trained enough staff. Now, if you take cancer, one of the important things, as you know, radiography, radiotherapy, taking pictures of people to see cancers, beaming in x-rays and similar streams of photons to treat people is very important. But we've got 25% of the jobs unfilled, thousands of people needing training. One way or another, despite all the bureaucracies, despite all the planning, it hasn't worked very well in making sure we've got the people in place.
Yes. And I mean, I've lived in America. I lived there for 10 years. My first child was born there. So I got some knowledge of the American system. And I know it's not perfect. A lot of people will tell you that many people do not get the cover that they need. But my elderly mother still lives there. And she gets very good care in various different ways, from hospitals to doctors to everything else, with a very small amount of insurance that she pays. And on any given time when she was put into a hospital for whatever reason and given a bill for $25,000 because she didn't have the money, they don't chase her for it. So it's not quite as bad over there as everybody makes out. And I think we could probably have some form of you know, mixed system which might help everybody here.
Whenever I'm in America, I enjoy it so much, I find it difficult to disapprove it. On paper, there are the sections of the population who don't get good care. If you're very rich in America, there's a danger of being overtreated. But there are quite a lot of people who get really world-class care in America. So what we need is a pragmatic approach which looks at the advantages of all systems and asks, what are we trying to do? How much are we trying to care for the weakest, the least able? How much are we trying to make sure we've got a system which benefits the strongest, the richest? How much are we looking for something in the middle which gives a pretty good deal for all?
Yes. Well, listen, I think this is the start of a beautiful friendship day, because I think there's a lot more for us to talk about at some point or other going forward. So let's do that and continue to seek the solutions to problems, because I think you're the kind of man that we can do that with. Professor David Taylor, pharmaceutical scientist at UCL.